Welcome back to The Cabin. This is the Up North podcast, heard live on Wednesday nights on the radio and on the weekends wherever you find your favorite Wisconsin podcast. I'm Sarah Yacoub, along with Kirk Bangstad and Pat Kreitlow.
And time for our next guest, UW Wisconsin Law Professor Keith Finley. He's the author of more than 50 law review articles and book chapters. His primary area of scholarship and expertise deals with wrongful convictions, criminal law and procedure, law and forensic science, and appellate advocacy. He's previously worked as an assistant state public defender in Wisconsin, both at the appellate and trial divisions. He has litigated hundreds of post-conviction and appellate cases at all levels of state and federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. He lectures and teaches internationally on wrongful convictions, forensic science, evidence, and appellate advocacy. Professor Finley joins us by phone. And Professor, nice to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be with you.
Awesome. So Professor Finley, this is Kirk. Thanks again for joining us. I found you through an old friend of mine. I always find these old friends from Wisconsin who just know some spectacular people. So I'm really happy you've joined us. This is getting beamed up to northern Wisconsin, but you're live in Madison on the radio right now. And we just talked to Louis Malepsky, who was the DA of Portage County. And we went through kind of, you know, as a DA, what are we hoping to accomplish? Kind of the ins and outs of the trial itself. I wanted to move the conversation to... first of all, I'd love to hear, you know, whatever you're able to say about what you thought about this case and how it reflects upon the judicial system of Wisconsin. Personally, I think it was a bit farcical. I think that the judge was out of bounds a lot at times. And I can't believe there's even a discussion, even a question of whether a minor who acted as a vigilante and actually killed people might get off. That's my own personal opinion. I'd like to hear your opinion, but I also want to bring it up a level, understand if Rittenhouse gets off, what are the repercussions for the state of Wisconsin and its judicial system? And potentially what are ways that we can, create more justice, I guess, in Wisconsin, if this doesn't work out the way that I'm hoping it works out, which is he gets prosecuted or he gets sentenced.
Yeah, there's so much going on in this case. There's so many levels at which one could examine it and think about it. From the purely legal level, what we've got is a really difficult case, believe it or not, under the laws as they're written, because it's a case where it's easy in terms of what happened. We all know what happened. We saw, you know, we've seen the videos. We've heard about all this stuff. But what makes it difficult under the law is that the law provides that Rittenhouse has a defense to shooting and killing two people, wounding a third, if he acted in self-defense. That is, if he reasonably believed that he was in danger of imminent death or great bodily harm. And the emphasis there is on the word reasonable. That's where it gets really difficult, is because the law doesn't provide much guidance to the jury in terms of figuring out what's reasonable. And so the individual jurors, essentially the legislature punted to the juries and said, you figure it out. You tell us what's reasonable and what's not. The problem is in a case like this, where there's such a wide polarized gulf between the views of the members of our society, what's reasonable to one person is going to look entirely unreasonable to another. So, you know, there are people who from the far right who support him and really like the idea of gun-toting people showing up at protests on behalf of black people who are shot by police, and then there are people on the left who probably share your perspective. And so how the jury is supposed to come to a consensus and reach a unanimous verdict, it's going to be really, really challenging. So just at the level of the judiciary, that's sort of the complexity that's involved there. But I really think you hit on something else there, and that is if you kind of zoom out and look at this not just under the technical terms of the legal statute, if you take that view of it, it's really kind of a bizarre scenario where you can have heavily armed teenagers showing up at politically fraught protests and putting themselves in a position where they might find themselves fearful, and where they, you know, it's sort of inevitable that somebody's going to get shot, and yet the law makes an accommodation for that. So I guess what I'm saying is that, zooming out, the thing that I think is sort of the elephant in the room that all of the pundits are sort of overlooking is the very reason we're in this mess right now with this case is because our laws authorize people to show up at political events armed with semi-automatic rifles and to act.
Exactly. Yeah. And as minors, and minors coming across state lines. And so I want to, both you and District Attorney Malevsky, really drilled down on self-defense. And I want to get at that versus vigilantism here, because I'm sure folks hearing this are hearing, wait a minute, what self-defense do you have when you cross state lines with an automatic weapon and stir up trouble? Now, maybe the comparison is imperfect. Forgive me for it, but we have such a culture and a debate about guns in this country that I want to set that aside for a moment. And we'll just do, an arsonist busts into a crowded theater and starts to set fire to something. But then somebody comes after him because, hey, you're setting fire to our theater. And but the guy defends himself and he ends up, killing a couple of the people in there. And yet he gets to claim self-defense, even though he's the one that was, coming into that area that he did not belong in with potentially lethal force. But you're telling us, despite the political overtones, despite the racial overtones, despite any problems we might see with systemic racism in the judicial system, the jury's just got to look at the specifics of this case. And it really is about, it all peels away. And it's just, does self-defense apply despite what brought him to Kenosha? Am I reading that right?
Partly, yes, but there's an important component to what you just said that we have to focus in on, and that is that in the scenario you described, actually the person going into the theater and setting fires would not be able to claim self-defense because there's a principle known as provocation, and that is, under the statutes, if someone provokes the response that makes them feel like their life is in danger, then they cannot rely on self-defense. That would clearly be applicable in the situation with the arsonist going into the theater setting fires. That would provoke a response from people in the theater to try to, attack that person and neutralize them. The problem is that the provocation only eliminates the self-defense claim if the provocation was itself an unlawful act, such as setting fire to the theater. That would be an unlawful act. And that gets back to the point I was making before. Under our laws, going to a politically fraught, racially tinged, public protest armed with semi-automatic rifles is not illegal.
And that's the amazing part. That's
crazy.
Is just amazing.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So that's why provocation may apply here, and the jury was instructed on that. But they'll have to decide that Rittenhouse actually did something not only that would provoke the attack on him, but that what he did was itself unlawful.
Well, and the thing that's interesting to me twofold is, one, where's the contributing to the delinquency of the minor for mom? But two, Pat, going to what you just said, the jury doesn't get all the information. They get it filtered through a judge whom I can't speak freely about as a member of the bar. So the... The issue for me is we've got a situation where Kyle is heard, I believe he's even on tape, looking at people he thinks are shoplifters and says, gee, I wish I had my AR-15 so I could pick them off. That, or I could shoot them. That very clearly speaks to his intent, but the jury never got the luxury of that. All they saw was, in that moment, is he, in fear for his life? And, taking away those key insights into what his thinking was, and he was trying to be Mr. Tough Guy in Kenosha, I think that makes it that much harder for the jury to get to the bottom of what's going on.
Yeah, I think you've hit on what is probably, if there was a legal error made by this judge, I think that's probably the strongest claim. of legal error, and that's because the judge excluded that because, as you know, under the law, there's a strong principle that you can't admit other acts evidence, that is, other things somebody has done, in order to prove their character or their propensity and to show that they acted in conformity with that character trait or propensity on this occasion. That's what the judge was relying on and excluding it, and that's fine as far as it goes. The problem is that rule is littered with exceptions and basically says things that somebody has done or said in the past are admissible if they're relevant not to prove character or propensity, but to show something else that's really relevant, something like motive, intent, plan. And in a self-defense case where the whole question is what is going on inside his mind, was he really acting out of a fear and a reasonable fear of death or great bodily harm, we need to get inside his head. We have no direct window into his head except what he said. That is the window into what he was thinking and doing. That is a clear statement of intent, of motive, that most courts, I really believe, would have admitted that evidence for that non-character purpose. And taking that away from the prosecution was a real body blow to the prosecution's case because that was such a critical point.
I agree.
So I want to take it, you know, I heard this kind of similarity or this scenario brought up, and I wanted to ask you using this scenario. So if a person of color, a black man, went into, you know, like the Charlottesville white power rally, armed with an AK, a semi-automatic weapon, and then, you know, potentially provoked, you know, raised the ante a lot because, you know, of course that's going to happen. And this same similar thing happened. People, you know, came at him and he started firing. Do you think in Wisconsin, this black man would have the same trial? You think, and potentially, and you know, and obviously I'm asking this to, because I think no, but I wanted you to kind of explain right. It. You know a hell of a lot more about, you know, criminal law in Wisconsin judicial system than I do.
Well, of course, theoretically, they're supposed to, right? But the only way I know how to answer that is to say you just have to look at the data. Look at the track record of our criminal justice system, and the track record is not good when it comes to treating black people the same way as white people. So, you know, could a black person have the same trial as this and have the same? Sure, they could, but the chances are far less likely just simply based on what we know about how our system operates. We know that black people are arrested at far higher rates for crimes, even where the rates of offending are the same as with white people. We know that at the next step of the process, black people who are arrested for the same crimes are tried more often than white people. They're convicted more often than white people. They're sentenced to prison once convicted more often. So we know that at every step of the process, it's not a level playing field. So could a black person, if the sort of the tables were turned and the races were reversed, could a black person expect a fair trial or expect to be treated the same as Rittenhouse? They could be treated the same, but there's an awful high risk that they wouldn't.
But Professor, what would you say to someone who says exactly that is why, you know, Trump's America is what they're fighting for, is we want to maintain this privilege that we get as a function of our skin color, and we don't want to be in the position of these people of color, and we know the inequities, and we were fighting to preserve them. I feel like we have this fight of trying to get people to understand the inequity where a substantial part of our audience is going, yeah, so I want to keep it that way. And how do we get people to understand the cost of injustice to everyone, that this is, we're not better off treating a subsection of our society as second-class citizens, especially when it comes to justice?
Boy, if I knew the answer to that, it'd be amazing. That is the difficult question. How do you get people to recognize their own privilege? How do you get people to recognize that the other is not something to fear, but to embrace? I don't know the answer to that. I think, you know, it's a long, long struggle. I just hope that that Martin Luther King Jr. was right. I hope he was right when he said, you know, the arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. I hope that's where we're going. But there's a lot of bumps along the road, that's for sure.
So, Professor, I think we got time for about one more question, and I just wanted to kind of take this at the highest level. Like, how does Wisconsin stop this from happening in the future if Kyle Rittenhouse gets off for being a minor vigilante and killing people? How do we fix this?
Well, as long as our politics are polarized, we're going to have volatile situations. As long as we have gun laws that allow people to carry semi-automatic weapons to protests or public disruptions, we're going to have dangerous situations where somebody's going to feel threatened and is going to shoot them. So we have to fundamentally change our attitude, but also fundamentally change our laws so that we don't create these kind of boiling kettles that are, I mean, this is, it's just a recipe for disaster. So we got a lot of work to do.
We really appreciate your insight on this. And again, we're asking you questions with no easy answers, but it's your insight that at least helps us see if there is a path to get there. University of Wisconsin Law School Professor Keith Finley, thank you again so much for joining us on the Up North Podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And we want to note as well, last year, Up North News, WI.com, did a story on systemic racism in the judicial system. You know, some 66,000 Wisconsinites are on parole or probation, all at risk of being locked up on a technicality. And, you know, about 40% of Black people released from Wisconsin prisons are locked up again within 3 years. That tells you that there's a problem with the judicial system that needs to be addressed, and we'll keep a focus on that. We'll be back after this. You're up north.